Lawyer by day, horn-headed vigilante by night. Just who is Daredevil? Raised in Hell's Kitchen NYC by his father, battling Jack Murdock, a young Matt Murdock lost his sight to radioactive chemicals while saving an innocent bystander. Now blind, his other senses grew to superhuman heights. Soon after, he met Stick, a blind martial arts master who trained Matt and helped him develop his abilities to become a formidable fighter. After his father's murder, Matt vowed to serve the legal system as best he could as an attorney, but would help those the law could not reach as the hero Daredevil. His life has been filled with more twists, turns, and tragedies than the devil himself. He's made countless enemies, but even more friends and allies along the way. Equipped with his heightened senses, a unique radar-like sense, ninja training, and his trusty billy club, which doubles as a cane, the streets of the Marvel Universe will always be protected by the man without fear.
Back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am joined today by my good buddies, Mr. Sean Whalen.
Pleasure to be here, buddy.
Pleasure to have you here. And Mr. Chris Eberle.
Paul, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on, Chris. And, you know, with Sean here, people would think it's an episode of Is It Yours? And they would not be 100% wrong, because what we're going to do today is going to tie into what's going to be released the next day. So today we're taking a look at the comic book or the Frank Miller version of Daredevil when he came onto the book up until when he did the Man Without Fear miniseries. And in tomorrow's episode, which through the magic of time travel will not actually be recorded tomorrow, we're going to review Daredevil on film, which would include a brief look at the trial of the Incredible Hulk and the Daredevil movie with Ben Affleck. And then we'll focus a little bit more deeply on the Netflix/Disney+ series. So it's all combined, and hopefully I'll be able to get Chris and Sean and who knows who else back for that one. But today, again, we're going to be taking a look at the Frank Miller comic book, Daredevils. So I wanted to give a little bit of a brief background on that. Frank Miller came onto the book with issue number 158. Before he had come on, I'm a fan of Daredevil. I've been a fan of the book since I started buying comics. But I have to admit, in a great deal of his history before issue 158, he seemed kind of directionless. They weren't sure exactly which way to go with it. Up until the point of 158, my favorite run was by Steve Gerber, which is a combination of it having been just a little out there and the fact that that's when I first started buying comics, when that one was going on. So in 158, he came in. The cover date on that is May of 1979. The story was written by Roger McKenzie, and it teamed Frank Miller and Klaus Janson for the first time and featured what I thought at the time was a huge mistake, the death or the demise of the Deathstalker, who I thought was a truly scary character, and I kind of liked the way he had been presented. So I was kind of disappointed that they killed him off. They continued in issue number 162. We had a fill-in issue written by Michael Fleischer and drawn by Steve Ditko. Then in 163, we had an issue featuring the Hulk, which to me was reminiscent of issue number 7 with the Submariner, where Daredevil was just up against a foe that he could not physically match. As of issue 165, Miller and Roger McKenzie were listed both as writers of the book. In issue 167, David Michelinie was listed as the writer. And issue 168 is the first one that established just Frank Miller as the writer. And that is also the introduction of Elektra as a character. Issue number 170 brought on the Kingpin as a major foe for Daredevil, co-opting him from Spider-Man. And as of issue number 171, the series, which had been floundering before Miller came on, then went monthly. Issue 181, we covered on Back to the Bins a while back, and Mr. Everly had been good enough to bring that issue in, and we waxed poetic about it, and it features the death of Elektra. Issue 183, once again, lists Roger McKenzie as a co-writer of the book. And then I thought it was interesting, which I had not realized at the time. In issue 185, Klaus Janson is listed as the artist. I had just always kind of pictured him and Miller working together. And there are points where they're listed as storytellers or whatever. And I'm thinking it's possible that Miller was giving either very detailed scripts as far as the layouts, or was giving some, you know, stick figure layouts and letting Janson finish them off, because they really do maintain the same appearance as what Miller had done earlier. Let's see. Issue number 191 is titled Roulette, and that was penciled by Frank Miller and inked by Terry Austin. And that's the point where Miller came off the book. He returned in issue 219 with art by, of all people, John Buscema. And I'm going to say up front that I thought that, as much as I totally respect Buscema and I think that his artwork has been beautiful through the years, I don't think that was the right combination. I don't think he had enough of a film noir feel for that. Then in issue number 226, which has a cover date of January of 1986, Miller came back on. The following issue started the Born Again storyline, which went to issue 233. I'm sure we're going to focus a little bit on that. And in 1993, there was the five-issue Man Without Fear miniseries, written by Miller and drawn by John Romita Jr. So that's a basic overview of Miller's run on Daredevil. I'll tell you, I was actively buying when Miller came on, and by the time he introduced Elektra, by the time he became the sole writer, I had become enamored enough with the storyline that I thought, this is going to be big one day. And I started buying two copies of each issue. So I was guilty of being one of the speculators out there that I hate so much. And I did at some point sell off the duplicate copies at a decent profit, but I think not quite as high as I could have gotten if I sold them today. But alas, I still have the originals. Interesting point is, as I've talked about on the show on many occasions, I have put end dates on series that I was collecting. For example, Spider-Man, I am interested in owning from Amazing Fantasy 15, which I probably will never own, up until issue 300. I've decided 300 is just the part where I'm stopping. For Daredevil, I had decided to stop at issue 200. And I may expand that now to include the Born Again storyline, just bring it up a few more issues, just because I feel like I need to own those. But with the current end of issue 200, I have 199 of the issues. Unfortunately, the one I'm missing is issue number one, which I probably will not find at an affordable price, but we'll see. I'm always looking for a bargain. So all that said, why don't I just get to you guys and just get a little bit of your background, the Daredevil as a character and Frank Miller coming in, and, you know, when did you read his storylines and, you know, what was your first impression of him?
Sean, go ahead.
So Daredevil was somebody as a kid I mostly encountered in Spider-Man guest appearances or Marvel team up. So I always knew him as a friend of Spider-Man. That was kind of my, and I enjoyed him. It was a budgetary thing. I didn't know much more about the character other than that. I enjoyed him every time I read him. The only other time I would have gotten single issues is I used to, I've referenced it many times, that I used to go to flea markets as a kid on like Sundays, and there are always these big boxes of comics that people didn't know what they were throwing in there, and I would get issues of Daredevil then. Always liked him. Just I didn't have the budget per se to follow that until it was actually Dark Knight Returns. I really enjoyed Miller's Dark Knight Returns. I'm a big Batman junkie. That's my guy, where I've got long runs with Batman. in both of the books, and really liked it and really wanted to read more of Miller's work. In 87, I believe it was, the Born Again Trade came out. And trades, it's like nowadays we throw trades. Exactly. Yes, that's exactly the one. Trades were not common then the way that they are today. Today, you kind of expect everything's going to eventually be a trade or in a hardcover and wide variety of different collections. It wasn't that. It was floppies. This came out, and I noticed Miller's name on it, knew it was Daredevil. I'm like, let me grab this. It blew me away. It was just such a great storyline. I still have that original trade. It's, you know, one of my favorite possessions, which is unusual for me because it's usually like the trades and hardcovers lead me to go seek out the singles. But that trade, I think just because it impacted me so much, is that's one I hold on to with an iron grip. And I, over the years, I went backwards and, you know, got various issues with Daredevil and continued following the character afterwards. That was really my jump on point. So it was 87. I was in high school at that point in time, and started to, you know, through my job and stuff like that, I started to have more of a budget. So Daredevil became a character I followed after that, because I really enjoyed his world, the rules of the world. Being a Batman guy, it's very easy to take characters with that archetype and kind of compare them to Batman and either call some of them Batman light or something like that. Daredevil's not that. And I think that in our discussion, we'll probably talk more organically about this, but I feel his world has some very grounded rules to them. His relationships with the people that he's in love with and he interacts with have a very grounded relationship. And this is not a knock on Batman. Batman's stuff tends to be a little more over the top. Whereas Daredevil's relationships, yeah, the characters, you can, on the surface level, if you're looking at them, you can say, well, yeah, they're trying to mimic kind of the Batman stuff. No, not when you get to know who these characters are and what they really do. Elektra's a great example. She's not Catwoman at all. Heather, you know, the relationship of Heather that he had with her, very, very grounded, very, very real relationship. Black Widow, even in the earlier parts of the run, when you see how that relationship kind of comes to an end and all that pieces, there's some very grounded elements of that piece that I think are very, very unique to Daredevil's world and his way of interacting with the heroes and his friends and all of those pieces, and even Kingpin. I mean, man, Born Again, when you take a look at it, that's not an out-of-continuity story. We really messed with this guy and everyone around him, Karen Page in particular. What they did with Karen Page and the way that that relationship went, I thought was stunning. So I'm kind of doing the diarrhea of the mouth thing right now, but that was my exposure to the character and what really drew me in to continuing to be a Daredevil reader. At what I think of is the best for Daredevil. I think the best writers understand that Daredevil's rules Daredevil's world has some very specific rules to it that make it unique. And you can't compare them to other characters in a similar archetype.
Oh, that was refreshing. Thank you, sir. For me, Paul, you were talking before about how Daredevil was kind of adrift in prior incarnations. And I value that because when I was growing up, I was exposed to different versions of the character almost simultaneously. So I got my Son of Origins for Christmas, and they had Daredevil 1 in it, and then they had issue 47, Brother Take My Hand, probably one of the best Silver Age issues. So I was blown away by the look, the Gene Colan artwork, especially in that issue 47, the character's world, you know, the fact that he was blind, but his senses were enhanced. All of that really just I was pretty young kid. It really captured my imagination. At the same time, I was buying back issues in used bookstores of the really wacky Bronze Age Daredevil. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Moondragon's in it and different characters like that. And, you know, Mandrill and all this nutty fun stuff and Black Widow. And I was really enjoying that. And then again, around the same time, went to another flea market and my parents bought me a back issue of Daredevil 181, The Death of Elektra. And that was my first exposure to Frank Miller on the character. And I mean, I came in 82, so it was, maybe it was 83, 84. So I was 9 or 10 years old, something like that. Even at that age, I understood that this is not, I've never seen this before in a superhero, you know, slash Marvel comic. And the imprint that made on me stayed with me ever since. I just reread that story. I mean, all these stories just in the past week, and that issue still has a singular power. So really looking forward to this conversation, gentlemen.
Well, I've gotten the impression, Chris, over our years of friendship now, that that Daredevil is one of the characters that you gravitate to, because when you've brought random books to the show, you have brought Brother Take My Hand The Death of Elektra. So, you know, with all the books out there that you could pick, the fact that you've done two Daredevil ones, sends a message, put it that way. So I agree. I think, despite the fact that the character was somewhat out of focus, I do think that there was always a groundwork of something quality in there, but that they had a tendency to drift into different things, much like my history with the original Captain Marvel, not the original Shazam Captain Marvel, Marvel Comics Captain Marvel, where the series, if you read through the series before Jim Starlin got there, they kind of changed their focus every five issues or so and tried to do something new to kind of invigorate the character. And I think Daredevil was a similar thing. And much like Jim Starlin invigorated Captain Marvel, Frank Miller invigorated Daredevil. It just took longer for them to get to that point. And I would imagine that Miller had, you know, one of these things where he said, hey, I'd like to really put my stamp on a character, and this series is running the risk of getting canceled, so why don't you just let me do what I want with it? And, you know, that was in the days, 1979, I think it's before Jim Shooter had come on as editor-in-chief, so, you know, the inmates were kind of running the asylum to begin with. So I think, you know, he knew he could get away with more than he might on a higher profile book.
And Paul, to piggyback on that, because having just read the whole run, so it's all fresh in my memory, those first few issues, it's kind of like they're gradually shedding the Bronze Age aspects of the character. Like, I think it's interesting that Deathstalker, who is a very Bronze Age villain, I agree, he's chilling, but he's a very Bronze Age Marvel villain, he dies in that issue. And once we get to 168, I think you can feel Miller just cutting free completely. And the whole tone of the book really just shifts. Suddenly we're basically in a film noir with a femme fatale in Elektra. And it just, that point forward, I mean, I really enjoyed reading those prior stories as well, because they're fun. Roger McKenzie, I think, was a very, you know, solid, good, like Marvel Bronze Age writer. But even there, you start to see the change. Like when Bullseye attacks the Black Widow and he's strangling her with a cord from a hairdryer, and like, okay, that's not 70s Daredevil. You know Miller put that in, like that. I've no doubt that he put that in. But once you get into the Elektra issue and beyond, and the other thing, like you guys mentioned, he completely revolutionizes the Kingpin. I mean, the Kingpin is you know, a really fun, sometimes a little goofy Spider-Man gangster villain. And now he's like this utterly terrifying, like spider at the center of some Machiavellian web. Like it's a really chilling character. And then you can understand how in the television show, I won't go into that too much, but D'Onofrio was obviously basing his Kingpin completely on this version of the character. So.
Yeah, and I don't want to go too deep into the television show, since we're going to do that on the Is It Yours episode.
That's all I'll say. Yeah, that's all I mean,
there is no question that Daredevil on film, from the Ben Affleck movie to now, is all motivated by the Frank Miller books, whether you like the Ben Affleck one or not. And we'll talk more about that when we get to that one. But you know, the only, if you want to see Daredevil before the Miller influence, then you watch The Trial of the Incredible Hulk.
Yep. that's a fond childhood memory, Paul. I remember disappointed.
It's got a certain charm to it. We'll talk about that when the time comes.
This book does share a lot of the energy of the creative freedom Claremont had when he took over X-Men. You know, I mean, it was the same kind of thing. There was a need for that book to kind of evolve and grow and a need for it to get some notice in what it was doing. And I liked how, you know, he had that freedom to do it. And you feel that with this. But I also, you mentioned something earlier, Chris, as you were talking about those early issues and how they connected to the Bronze Age and kind of linked through. I really appreciate when creative teams, and we're going back a ways right now, when creative teams build that bridge, you know, versus the jarring change. I think there's something to be said for, you know, respecting the fact that there are readers who have been there all along.
Yep.
And you want to bring, yes, we're going to be doing some wild stuff and really changing your world, but getting them there gradually and introducing new concepts along the way, I think just works really well. And I felt that in this run, the early issues, going back and rereading them. I didn't notice that as much. And I really was connecting when you were pointing that out. Cause I'm like, I don't remember these issues having that kind of feel to them when I read them in the past. I think reading them for this just gave me a fresh lens into that. And I really like the fact that they do have a Bronze Age feel in their show, which is something that I think if you focus solely on the later Miller stuff, you don't really catch that, like, those early issues really were a growing and bridging point to all of this, which I think is really, I think for anybody that's got long runs of Daredevil can feel like this character got there gradually.
And at the core of that, Daredevil's a swashbuckler.
Yes.
And I mean, that was very much his Silver Age persona. But even into the Miller run, like when he's running on the bridge and the old man is jogging and he's just bantering with him. And, you know, it's like you can almost imagine, like, okay, that's Errol Flynn as Daredevil or something like that. Like, so that, I think all the creators, if they really know the character, there's always at least a little hint of that. And like, I mean, the Mark Waid Chris Somney run, that's, I think, such a wonderful sort of return to that type of interpretation of the character. But it's always there in some form, I think.
And I think that's, you know, and I really don't want to drift off the Miller Daredevil too much, but I do think, much like with Batman, Daredevil has been somewhat of a victim of Miller's run, because everybody saw what Miller did with the character and they're trying to either recreate that or build on that. And certainly there's nothing wrong with building on it, but it is hard to take one of the seminal runs of comics in the last 50 years and then say, well, I'm going to try and one up it. And that's almost what a lot of these issues feel like. Well, you know what? Miller really, really put him down in the gutter. I'm going to make it even worse for him, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, I do think nobody did it as well as Miller did. There's been some successful runs since his, but I do think this is the standout. And as you said earlier, Chris, that, you know, it's got the film noir feel to it. And I do think, and I found this interesting even when the books were coming out, when I was, you know, less driven to be more, you know, to be a critic and more just reading it for fun, that the Miller style, you know, is a little bit sketchy and it's not really very focused on getting anatomy exactly right. But I was drawn to it, even though those are things that I, you know, I like a cleaner drawing and I like anatomy to be pretty on point. And yet I was still drawn to these books. And I do think it was the storytelling that drew me to them more than the artwork itself. But because the storytelling was so strong and because the storytelling pulled me in so much, I started to love the artwork. So it's a strange situation with that. And I started to analyze that a little bit in my mind, saying, you know, I saw where Miller has done some covers and that didn't seem to me to be the right kind of fit, because if I'm attracted to him because of his storytelling, you're not going to get that on a cover. And yet some covers are outstanding. So, you know, it's almost like, you know, a contradiction of terms, you know. And but I even look at the very first issue, that 158 with the Deathstalker's demise, and that cover is
it's a great cover.
Yes. I think that, you know, that's one of the all time. That's an A+ cover as far as I'm concerned. So what do I know is what it comes down to.
I think with Miller's art,
excuse me,
and Gesundheit, I think with Miller's art in rereading everything, you really come to appreciate how important Klaus Janson is to the entire process. And as you mentioned earlier, Paul, those latter issues where he was doing the at least the bulk of the penciling and of course the inking, you really see how much of this Miller Daredevil we love is really because Janson's probably providing all like the sinew to everything. I mean, it's fantastic artwork. And his role is really essential. For example, what really struck me was the rendering of Elektra, her eyes, her face. She looks like a real woman who is just stunningly beautiful. And like the expressions of anguish on her face, like Elektra, when they bring her back and all that, she kind of looks, they kind of draw her in like a very sort of generic way, with the outfit and her look. This was like, this looks like a real person.
Yes.
And that's no easy feat. So, this is a classic team.
Tone, atmosphere, and mood, and emotion. Emotion is like a biggie. Sometimes when we talk about, we forget about that piece. But I feel like those pieces where I'm with you, Paul, as far as what I prefer in my art style. But I think there are certain artists where they'll sit there and go, you may think you don't like this. Smack. And when you get creative teams that really start taking you, and I think there is that marriage between the writing and the art, that when you get it right, you change the rules for everybody. I love that Hell's Kitchen also has that kind of grounded kind of feel to it. That was something that I don't typically think of Hell's Kitchen in comics as being one of the big cities or the big, you know, atmospheres, until I read this stuff and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is cool.
Well, their rendering of cityscapes.
Yes.
And making those cityscapes such an intimate part of the story. For example, you can see his Will Eisner influence, where in a lot of the title pages, he's worked the title into, you know, the buildings or litter or debris or whatever it might be. And again, the noir is all over this stuff. I mean, they even have one when he goes to a movie theater and they're watching the Maltese Falcon, right? So, yes. Yeah. It's an approach to Daredevil we hadn't seen up to that point, but it just once they really apply it, it's like you feel like it's almost always been this way. Obviously, it hasn't been, but the character just fits so well into that atmosphere. And there's no more supervillains. That like notice the supervillains are just gone. It's the Kingpin, it's gangsters, it's tapping that 80s pop culture zeitgeist of ninjas, which as a 12-year-old kid, I was just thrilled every time the hand would appear. And you know, the chase just blew the top off of my head. So this was, especially as an older person, having, you know, read noir and watched film noir, you really appreciate what he was trying to do here.
His fantastic use of Maltese Falcon. I don't want to let that go for a second, because when you're bringing that up, people, they throw in like popular movies or classic movies all the time into comics and things like that. Rarely do they use them the way this book did in that sequence. That was a brilliant use of incorporating it into the story, where it wasn't just a film that was being watched. Yep. It was a storytelling element.
Yep.
And that part I thought was just, there's a detail there that was done that was so cool in the way that they did it, that I really appreciated.
Well, yeah,
go ahead, Paul.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, normally when you have a moment like that, where you have a movie that's being focused on in a comic, it's more for the sake of the nostalgia of the title, you know, having the Mark of Zorro, you know, at the death of you know, the Waynes. But the actual movie isn't really played upon. Whereas this, that, you know, that you have the movie geek sitting there kind of doing a running commentary on the movie while the fight is going on with Bullseye, and, you know, we're getting a correlation of it. And I guess in my mind, that leads me to the next thing that I was thinking, is how masterfully, and I don't know if it's Janson or if it's Miller or if it's a combination of the two, but how masterfully the fight sequences are choreographed in these books. You know, a lot of times, as a fan, you can sit there and say, you know, the battle is what you want, the battle is what you're leading up to. When all is said and done and breaking down the book, the battle is probably the least important element. It's just the, you know, the big conclusion, the, you know, of the the whole story, because if the story doesn't build up right, then the battle is meaningless. In Miller's books, or Miller and Jansen's books, the battle is so well rendered that it becomes storytelling unto itself. And that is something that I really enjoy, because I find myself, when I read these books, I could easily, you know, I could easily page through a battle scene very quickly, just, you know, read the text and move on. But I find myself focusing on the shots, the artwork of, you know, what angle they're coming at and who's coming at what, and, you know, and it feels real. There's actually like a power to these battle scenes that you rarely see in comics. So, you know, I think you kind of hit on it either in the conversation today, and if you haven't hit on it fully, I think you hit on it when we talked about issue 181, you know, whatever it was, a year ago. This is a mature level book. This is a book that, you know, you wouldn't give this to your 8-year-old nephew, even if you did have it at that age.
Yeah.
You know, you generally wouldn't.
It was the 80s, Paul. It was the 80s. Come on.
It's a different time. I often wax poetic about how my dad took me when I was, I think, 7 years old with him when he went to see Dirty Harry. And it's one of my favorite movies of all time.
It's a great
movie. It certainly did not leave a negative mark on me in any respect. But, you know, as a parent, you gauge the maturity level of your child and what they can and can't take. And I think my dad knew, even though I'm still a child at heart, I think my dad knew I could watch that movie. I understood it was just a movie and it wouldn't, you know, spook me or, you know, set me on a murderous, you know, rampage or anything like that. So, you know, I think he knew. I think, you know, you were probably in a similar situation reading Daredevil at a similar age, except perhaps your parents didn't even realize what they were getting for you.
They may not have, but my parents were always very progressive about what I could read or watch or listen to. So I think I ultimately lucked out and benefited from that. I think you made a great point, though, just to emphasize the combat scenes. This isn't like, you know, pow, bam, zap, you know, boof. You feel like you're looking at martial arts moves. Now, I'm not an expert in martial arts, but like when Bullseye ambushes Elektra in 181, there's like two pages where there's no sound. It's just them fighting. And it is as riveting a fight scene you'll see in any comic. And like you can follow the flow of their movements as they're trying to parry each other and how they incorporate a car into it. And then when he rams her own sigh right through her chest, I was a kid. I was like, oh my God. Like, you know, that's not something I was ever used to seeing in any kind of, you know, sort of mainstream superhero comic. But
I think I'm about 10 years older than you, Chris. Yeah. And when I read it, I also went, oh my God.
Yeah.
So
my voice even cracked to simulate puberty from back in that time period. But
where it also the Peter feels Brady real. Going.
What's that, John?
Where it also feels real is like that sequence where Daredevil was being drowned. You know, he's being put in there trying to shove the lid out.
Yep.
Fighting his way. Like, we're still seeing him kick his feet out. We're still seeing him try to fight his way. I loved we talk about realism. That is real. You're not going to just kind of go, okay, go ahead and drown me right now. You're going to fight it back. But I like that it was rough. You know, it was not clean. The fight sequences in Daredevil feel different every time. And they don't feel like over choreographed. They feel like they are a poetry that's going on, a ballet that's going on for the purpose of the story.
Yeah.
They're not overdone. It's where you feel like he's been trained. There's, you know, those pieces that are in there. You also feel that he's unique to Elektra, which I think is a real important piece with those characters. You know, Daredevil's blind. He's got his senses, and the way that he fights is going to be different. They both feel like they're trained and skilled, but it's different. And there's some parallels, sure, but I like that you see how the two of them complement each other while at the same time they can surprise each other. And I love that kind of element. And that happens the same thing with Bullseye and other characters like that. And that it doesn't feel like the same thing keeps reoccurring over and over again in a Daredevil comic in this run. And it's something that I just really enjoyed.
Well, I think you have a great point about the fighting style, because basically what is Daredevil? He is a gymnast. He is a ninja. And he's got a billy club that shoots a nylon line, and that's it. Right? Like, I mean, not to diminish that, but there's no sensational bombastic powers. It's just this incredibly dangerous guy who, you know, can survive dealing with the Hulk.
Yes.
I mean, he's badly injured, but that's what makes the character, I think, so special. Go ahead, Paul.
I'm sorry, I was going to say, and I think Miller made him more special by separating him. You know, he was first introduced as almost a, you know, here's another guy like Spider-Man. You know, like that was almost the introduction. Yep. You know, we're going to give him powers due to radioactivity. And Miller stripped that away. Miller and I, you know, and I want to talk a little bit about Stick, and I want to talk about Kingpin, and I want to talk a little bit more about Elektra, but when he's with Stick and Stick is telling him that radioactivity wore away a long time ago, you're not dependent on that anymore. It's like, okay, now he just brought him right back to the basics and made us understand that he is this ninja that you just described him as. He's not a superhero. He's just a hero. He doesn't have superpowers. He's just trained to the ultimate level that you can be trained. The radioactivity served to maybe open up the ability to get these senses.
Yeah, it was
that ability was always innate.
Yeah.
Well, that's so, what you know, Stick, and that's something that Miller says, did.
Yeah. Oh, that's all. You know, completely. Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody ever hit on that in any respect. It was always the radioactivity, and I think, you know, everybody realized after a while that, you know, Stan relied a little too much on radioactivity as the source of everybody's powers, and they, you know, decided to, you know, when we can separate from that, let's do that. You know, because otherwise it's just, you know, everybody's got the same thing. And, you know, I mean, I know I'm wandering afield here, but, you know, they also have done some things where they said, okay, you know, let's combine things a little bit. That gamma bomb that went off, not only did that create the Hulk, but that had an influence on other things that went on. And the superhero serum, let's say, you know, that had an influence on other people and their creation. So, you know, there is an effort to make it a cohesive world and not just this world where radioactivity runs wild, creating powers. Although, you know, when one of my friend's sons went to work at some lab out in California, and I kept saying, if he comes home without superpowers, I'm going to be disappointed. So let's talk about Stick a little bit.
Sure.
I mean, I think his creation was brilliant. And not only does he give Daredevil a background that we never saw before, but he is a character, you know, he's a somewhat original character, or a very original character, because he's not likable in any way, but he does have a certain proprietary feeling towards Matt and Elektra.
Yeah. I mean, he's a pool hustler. Among other things,
but he's not a good guy, but he's the mentor. He's the guy who, you know, who trained him, and it's almost like, you know, it's the guy who wants to teach somebody how to swim and says, okay, I'm going to drop you into 12 feet of water, and either you're going to get out or you're not, and that's Stick's method of teaching. So I just thought he was brilliant.
And it's interesting that as that storyline develops, it's almost as if they bring some sort of like 1930s pulp mysticism into it, which again really works with the whole noir atmosphere and, you know, Stick and the chase and the absorbing of energy and all of that. It's far out, but it still works in what has been they've been establishing up to that point. So I was such a sucker for ninjas when I was a kid in the 80s. Oh.
But it was ahead of its time, because I think, you know, in the years to come after that, and not immediately, you know, quite a while later, but in the years to come, storylines were designed to be a little bit more faithful to reality. They wanted to have them a little bit more grounded. You know, they would have the fantastic, but the fantastic had to have an explanation that made sense. It had to have something where you'd say, this could exist in the real world. All right, we're not going to believe that somebody came to Earth from the planet Krypton and has powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. But if one did, how would it react? How would the world react? Like, that's the effort that goes on nowadays. And sometimes it fails and sometimes it's successful. But I think Miller was ahead of his time by making that the way he did things in 1980, which is way before that became in vogue.
And I think where that really is emphasized, Paul, is, and you mentioned this before, is the Heather Glenn character and her relationship to Matt, which by the end is deeply disturbing. And like, I think Heather is probably not the most popular of Daredevil's love interests throughout his publishing run, because they kind of established like a flighty socialite, because she goes back into the 1970s. But by the time Miller and Jansen get their hands on her, Matt almost he's almost indifferent to her in some ways. And when Elektra appears, and this is where Miller starts to establish that Matt Murdock is starting to have a breakdown slowly, but surely, of the reemergence of this woman who had this overwhelming effect on him when he was younger. And Heather is victimized by this. And then at the point where he basically uses legal skills to destroy her own company, so then she'll marry him. That's really messed up. But it feels, it's so visceral, because this is not like, you know, we're going to ignore what Sue says in the Fantastic Four, and she's, you know, has an apron on, and or the Wasp is just a airhead. Like, this is a dysfunctional relationship.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
It's one of the areas where I really love Daredevil, because I mentioned before the any comparisons to Batman and things like that. We see Batman as the billionaire socialite, and yeah, he'll, you know, end relationships and stuff like that, because he can't let them get too close. But there's always this sense of, as the reader, we feel some sort of nobility to the character, even though we sometimes, you know, can scold Bruce on some of his choices and things like that. It's never like to the point where like he's really off.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, maybe in some later runs, sure, but this was really different. I mean,
yeah, it was.
You know, we all have made mistakes in our lives. We've all, you know, there's a humanity. I think it's where you can kind of connect more with Daredevil.
Absolutely.
Is the fact that you sit there and go, wow, this is my guy, and he really screwed up.
Yep. He screws up all the time.
I can't apologize for him. It's one of those things, if I met him in person, he was asking me about this, I'd be like, listen, dude, I love you, but ooh.
Yep.
And I mean, that part, feeling like so, and there's consequences. That's one of the things with the book. There's real organic consequences.
Yes, there are.
Aren't like a one or two issue consequence. These take place over time, and you get to really see the overarching impact. And sometimes they come back around later, where it's, you know, you stepped away for a little bit, but then it comes back and rears its head.
And Heather does not meet a good end.
No.
Later on in the series.
And it's weird to say that I like that, but I feel like there should be some form of consequence to where that storyline was going. And that's something that I found that is refreshing about the comic, is the fact that everything has an impact. There's nothing that's a throwaway, and they're all building towards larger things. It's something where you get a writer who's able to have a run and be able to really take characters through a journey. You get these types of things, and it's why when we get the rare opportunities to be able to read this type of run with some kind of beginning, middle, and somewhat ending, you know, with as far as comics actually end, it's something that's really refreshing. I love the impact of this.
Well, think about when this is also messed up. When Foggy and Natasha she counterfeits those notes that they give to Matt and Heather, each thinking that the other one is ending it with them. I mean, like, oh my God. It's reading that, I'd forgotten about that. Reading that again, I was floored by that they were so devious about trying to, in their mind, put Matt back on the right path, so to speak. But it was This is dark stuff. And by the way,
interesting go ahead, thing. Paul. I thought it was an interesting thing to bring the Black Widow back into the series, because it was an interesting combination in the first place when they brought her into it in issue. Oh, I'm tempted to say 95 around there.
Somewhere in that area. Yep.
That they, you know, when they brought her into the series in the first place, I thought it was an interesting, you know, an interesting experiment, and it lasted for quite a while.
It sure did, being
a team. So then we had, I don't know, maybe 3-4 years went by. She hadn't been a regular in the storyline, and then they brought her back in, and there's a terrific battle scene with her and Bullseye.
Oh yeah,
when he takes her out. And it was, in some ways, it's disappointing that she didn't put up a stronger fight against him, even though she...
Well, the Black Widow we're used to today would have been a much harder to defeat, if he could have defeated her at all.
But having him, you know, having her defeated and become the damsel in distress, I don't know if I would have made that choice, but it's still handled well, because then when that goes on, and then, you know, she's ready to come back and you know, rekindle her romantic relationship with Matt, but he's too entangled with all of this mess of a relationship that he's got with Heather. And when the Widow and Foggy do what you just described, the letters and all of that, you never get the impression that the Widow's doing it for her own advancement. She's never doing it like, well, if he breaks up with Heather, then he'll come to me. Or at least certainly never feels that way. It feels like she's doing it like, he needs to get out of this toxic relationship, and I'm going to do whatever I can to help that happen, even if it is a little, you know, questionable. You know, and it's just well done, because she sees the deterioration of Matt's personality or his sanity to some extent as it's going on. And then you add Elektra into the equation, and he's totally messed up.
And speaking of Foggy, I think Miller does the definitive Foggy Nelson. I think he really got the essence of the character that you saw in the earlier incarnations, but like Foggy was, I think he was the DA at one point, and you know, you saw like the bit of that sort of Abbott and Costello thing they had going on there a little bit and all of that. But I think Miller just really got why Foggy is so important to Matt, because he's so human in his bumbling and his dad jokes, and you know, it's just his whole. But he's also a great lawyer, and he just grounds Matt. Like in Born Again, I mean, he's the only one who's really trying to help Matt clear his name, and you know, they're working together, and it's a really special character. I think he's one of the great supporting characters in the whole sort of Marvel universe, essentially.
I agree, and I think he has been handled on occasion disrespectfully. I think he's been handled on occasion where he's just this bumbling fool who Matt is carrying through life.
That's appeared on occasion, yes.
I don't care for the Foggy being presented as Doiby Dinkles or whatever the heck his name is from Green Lantern. You know, I want him to be maybe a nerd at heart, because we all, you know, we all have our nerd vein in us, and we don't, you know, we can relate to that. But you want to see him being very competent as an attorney. In fact, I think he really... to do things on a grounded level, I think he has to be very competent as an attorney, because Matt, as good as he is undependable, because he's got other things that keep him busy. So you need somebody who's there running the day-to-day business, who's going to be, you know, able to really handle it well. So he's got to be a good attorney for legal practice, but he also has to be a good businessman to keep the money coming in to the practice. So you need to show Foggy as that, as well as being a lovable, you know, clown to an extent.
And Miller, go on, Sean, go ahead.
I was going to say, the other thing with the two of them is there's a loyalty there, but again, there's been rifts and, you know, ups and downs in the relationship. I like that Foggy hits certain points in time where he can't take a whole lot more of Matt's nonsense.
Yep.
Now, you know, I mean, the friendship comes back. The relationship comes back, but there's that has to be built to that point. And that's something you don't often see in comics with your confidants and things like that. They usually tend to be a lot more static and solid than what that looks like. Occasionally you'll get a little bumpy road, but never to the depth that you get it with Foggy and Matt.
Yeah, I agree.
And I really felt that that's something when we talk, A lot of times we talk about comics being grounded, comics being real. We rarely see the amount of elasticity that Daredevil's enjoyed in some of the better runs. And this is a great example of that, where you get to see relationships really put to the test in a way that you can connect with, because we've all had that in life, right? And it's one of those things that I think makes this feel more special in what it does, because there's very few books that take these kind of risks.
And like Foggy, Miller also totally reinvents Ben Urich.
Yes.
And he makes Ben Urich, like in a great film noir, he's like the narrator, a narrative device that frames many of the stories. They even changed the font of his lettering when he's thinking out loud. It's like a typewriter type font, because he's, you know, he's the newsman. And he's such an important character. I mean, obviously in Born Again, he's absolutely vital in that story. But his friendship with Matt, and the fact that Ben and Miller, this is all Miller again, Ben has the scoop of a lifetime. He knows who Daredevil is and he can prove it. Mm-hmm. And this is his ticket, you know, out of his crappy apartment with his wife, and he can get the Pulitzer Prize, and he just puts it in his drawer because he realizes how important it is what Matt does for the city. So he's a great character. Also, but like you guys were saying, there's still that humanity. Like when Elektra, and that's such a chilling scene when she kills the informant in the movie theater, and you see the blade not pierce the shirt, just stop at the very precipice of that, and the terror in Matt's eyes. And then later on, when she impales him in a few issues down the road, and he's like, I'm done. You know, he's considering just walking away from the whole thing. He has the great scene where he's talking to the copy boy about, you know, I was a fool. And that's such a human character. And Born Again too, when his fingers are broken and he's like, I don't even want to say Matt Murdock's name anymore. So like you said, consequences.
Consequences, but on a level where you say that makes sense. And that's important to it. It's you know, I don't like, and there's always this contradiction in how I feel about certain things. I don't like when writers tend to shy away from superheroism in comics, where they're almost embarrassed by it. You know, we have to go to leather costumes because nobody would wear spandex, that kind of attitude. But on the other hand, and with equal emphasis, I love when somebody does that in a way like this, where it's just, where it's a page turner. So I guess the bottom line is, I don't like when it's done just for the sake of doing it. But when it's done right, I'm totally on board with it.
Well, for example, Paul, to piggyback on that, the heart of the Miller arc is the story about the Kingpin trying to take control of the city through the mayoral election, the candidate Cherry or Sherry. And you feel the stakes if the Kingpin succeeds in his gambit. And when the scene where Daredevil tosses Vanessa's ring at him, and the art is unbelievable, because you see the Kingpin's, because he's usually so stoic and impassive and just this being of pure power, his mask just breaks and it's just complete grief on his face, and he looks at him, he goes, what do you want? And that's cinematic stuff right there. Like that's reading that again, I was like, wow, this is still really good.
I think the entire run is cinematic, and the entire run could be looked at as storyboards for a movie.
Yep.
I
agree.
It's just so well put together.
You mentioned Ben earlier, and there was something, you talked about the story, right? I think one of the things this run also did well, that I think it set the foundation, and I don't know that any book has been able to deal with this topic of secret identity the way that Daredevil has. It's a lot of times, you know, in comic books, when somebody finds out who's close to the character that they have a secret identity, there might be an initial reaction, maybe an issue or two of that type of thing. But then it's like, well, why didn't you just tell me all along? Mm. This book tells you why you don't tell people.
Yeah.
I mean, oh my gosh, that secret being currency a lot of times, that secret's being responsibility, that secret being dangerous to you. Not talking about just to the hero, but to those surrounding the hero.
Yep.
this book really says, like, listen, don't tell me. I don't want to know who you are. And if you do tell me, get somebody to make me forget, because, yeah. Oh my gosh, does this book really, really mess with that concept? And I love that because it's currency. And
well, and I'm sorry, please, Sean,
no,
go ahead.
No, go ahead. No,
I mean, the ultimate example of that is, of course, Karen Page.
Yes.
Bartering away the identity. And think of all the lives that are adversely affected because of that moment. I mean, numerous people die as a consequence of it. And, you know, Matt is already, I mean, Born Again is my, if I had to pick, I'm on an island, what's the story I have with me? It's that book. It's the exact same trade that you mentioned before, Sean, that I held up in front of the camera. That story, I mean, talk about consequences.
Yes.
Or think about how Miller and Mazzucchelli brilliantly use Captain America in that story. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, what he's questioning. I remember, because I was reading Daredevil monthly at that point. That was like 1985, 86. I was in middle school. It gave me chills then, and it still does certain scenes today. I think it's a transcendent piece of work. And I think it's the culmination of everything Miller had been doing with the character. Because we saw in the old 80s stuff we're talking about as well, you can see Matt is starting to have a breakdown. I mean, at the end, he's like clutching, he wants to dig up his dead lover. So, you know, that's... He's really round the bend at that point. But, you know, think about it. The life he's leading is insane by any normal human standards. So it stands to reason eventually there's going to be a mental impact. And you know, Elektra returning clearly was the catalyst for that. I mean, his treatment of Heather was also a result of that as well. So you're right on the money, Sean. Like the consequences, the choices people make, they resonate well into the many issues forward.
So now I think before we get to Born Again, we should focus for a moment on the Kingpin and how he's used. Now, Kingpin was introduced in Spider-Man number 50. He was a quality character from the start.
Oh yeah.
I mean, there was no point where he was, well, I got to take that back. I was going to say there was no point where he was poorly handled. I'm not so crazy about the way he was used in Captain America.
You mean where he's the actual head of Hydra?
Yes.
Great Bronze Age stuff, man. That's great Bronze Age stuff.
Yeah, and you know what? I could enjoy reading that, but I don't want to consider that as part of his character's history. Yeah. But when he came over to Daredevil, when Miller took him and stole him from Spider-Man, he gave the character much more depth than he had previously.
Oh, God, yeah.
They had started to lay some of the groundwork. They had, you know, his relationship with Vanessa.
Yes, that's always there, yep.
And there was the issue of Spider-Man where he had promised by the end of, you know, by the time the clock, rings 12, I'm done with my criminal background. And he was just about to defeat Spider-Man and the clock starts chiming and he has to walk away because he had promised Vanessa he would. You know, of course, his non-criminal activities didn't last that long. But as good as some of that was, Vanessa was a very one-dimensional character as presented in those stories. She was just the MacGuffin for the Kingpin. When Miller took over the character, he brought her in, he gave her some more dimensions, and he gave the Kingpin more, and he made the Kingpin a character to be feared.
Oh, yeah.
That he had his tendrils in he had his tendrils in everything, and you couldn't trust anyone to not be on his payroll. So, you know, you had to fear everything, and he really rarely got his hands dirty. You know, he pretty much let other people do it. He hired Bullseye as his assassin. He hired Elektra as his assassin. He hired, I can't even remember now, the older guy with the crime
organization. Oh, Eric Slaughter.
Slaughter, yes.
Yep.
He had him. And he just kind of was constantly manipulating. In his own way, he was as well portrayed a strategist as Captain America is. Mm-hmm. That, you know, he was thinking three, four moves ahead of everybody else. And it's just made him a terrifying villain, really.
Well, I think a great example of the stratagems, Paul, is the scene in Born Again where he's recruiting Nuke. And so he's transformed his entire office into like this nationalistic, like right-wing chamber, you know, all the iconography and muskets and American flags. And when Nuke comes in, he's clutching the flag to his breast, the kingpin. And he's talking about how, you know, he is the corporation that's called America. And, you know, it's a chilling speech. And unfortunately, I can see certain political leaders today saying similar things. But it just shows how he was willing to manipulate whoever he needed to manipulate to achieve his objective. And when he unleashes Nuke, it's one of the scenes that still just gives me a jolt, is he's watching the destruction through his binoculars and his aides are panicking. And he's just like, did you hear that? The earth trembled. And he's getting off on this. He said, I brought a war from South America to the streets of Hell's Kitchen. It's like, this is an evil man. Like this is, well, but a mesmerizing the character.
He is 100% amoral.
Yeah.
He's got his own, you know, ends, and whatever he has to do to get there, that's what he's going to do. Yep. You know, let the chips fall wherever they might. He doesn't really care. The only one he cares about besides himself is Vanessa.
And Miller does a nice job of this is what would always the great creators do. They don't dismiss what came before. They incorporate it, and then maybe they put their own sort of take on it. So the classic, you know, Kingpin will always discipline any of his goons when they mention his wife. So in the Silver Age, you'd be like, you mentioned my wife, and it'll like backhand a guy. So in Born Again, after Hell's Kitchen has been lit up in flames, it's actually kind of funny. He's in the sauna with his lieutenants, and the one lieutenant is so upset at the loss of profit that he mentions Vanessa, and he just breaks his neck right in front of everybody else. So it's Miller just taking that classic concept of the Kingpin's character, and he puts that very edgy, dark twist on it.
Giving him and Vanessa moments together that showed us why he would even care about Vanessa was pretty critical in adding to all that too.
Oh yeah.
Because when we do experience Kingpin going through the loss of Vanessa, that has to matter. Like you have to see how that's going to like snap him, you know, and just kind of go, okay, rule books. This was holding me from doing what I could do.
Yep.
You want me to be the Kingpin again? All right, I'll be the Kingpin again.
Yep. It's
so it brings us really to Born Again, which I'm gonna, before we talk a little bit about that, I want to say there was an episode of CGS where Chris did a masterful job of breaking down Born Again and going through the different elements of it. And I don't think we're going to hit on it. I know we're not going to hit on it in depth the way they did in that show. So if you could seek that one out, I would absolutely recommend it.
That was a lot of fun to record. Thanks, Paul.
So, but what I was struck by in Born Again was the premise is that the Kingpin is going to break down every aspect of Matt Murdock's life. He's found out that that's who Daredevil is, and he's going to destroy him on every possible level. And basically, he does. He essentially does. So now, the challenge in doing that, and I think there's a challenge in doing it in a believable way, which he does, but then the real challenge is, okay, now you've gotten there. He's at the nadir. He's been beaten down as far as you can be beaten down. How are we going to bring him back and make him into the hero that he is, or show the core of his nature that is that heroic ability? And I think that is what makes Born Again truly a great story, because I've read a lot of novels over the years where the buildup is great. And then when you get to the resolution, you're like, okay, I guess, you know, it's the journey, not the destination. And you walk away and say, at least I enjoyed reading it. But when they can when they can, you know, take it to a successful landing and really have an ending that you find satisfying and believable and logical, that is when you get a truly great story. And I think that's what we got in Born Again.
Well put, sir.
Some of my favorite sequences, that punching bag sequence is a piece of brilliance. The way that the whole thing was laid out, dialogue going, everything that went around that was perfect. The sequence where he punches through that door and that fist is coming through and he kicks through the door, leading to the fight that it led to, was just so cool because of where he went. You know, the fact that this guy has, and it's when he comes through that door, he's back, but like we still know that's a journey, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And that part, I feel like the continued layers of building back up. Paul, you were saying before about build, how do we build that hero again? It was, that was something that journey of climbing back up the ladder was something that really, there's that breathtaking moment where he's clutching Karen. I just think it means so much more with everything that it took to get to that point.
And I think the linchpin of all the thing we're describing is that Miller, once again, goes into the history and brings us Matt Murdock's mother.
Yes.
Who he's always thought was dead. That was just assumed. And, you know, that she played a key role when he first, you know, started to realize his abilities when she goes to the hospital. And, I mean, obviously Miller's almost making Murdock almost like a resurrected messianic figure to some degree, in sort of like he's reborn. And, you know, the scene where Maggie is praying to God to spare him and describing like he's going to be like a lightning bolt in your hand. And you, I mean, there's real gravitas because, you know, she's a woman of faith and she recognizes the role her son is playing in the city. And, you know, when the other, you know, nun says, you know, he's lucky to be alive. And she just said, you know, God is just. And I'm not a person of faith, but those scenes still really, I think, have tremendous resonance, because when he returns as Daredevil in the costume, in that the fire is behind him, and you know, I mean, I think we're supposed to certainly make certain conclusions about what's being referenced there. It's it's powerful stuff. And Ben's narration through all of those scenes, I think, is critical to what makes the story as great as Paul was describing before. You know, he's a brilliant journalist, but he's also just an everyman. And essentially, he's watching, you know, demigods. And when for me, one of the great scenes in the whole book is when the Avengers appear, just for a moment, sort of representing like the federal power kind of coming down. Like you guys said before, Daredevil's never really fully been part of that world. He's like in the periphery. He'll pop up, but sometimes in other books, he came into the Avengers a few times, right in the Bronze Age, Spider-Man a bit. But he's really just his own thing for the most part. And I think Miller really reminds us of that in his interaction with Captain America, where the scene where Steve says, you know, he wears the flag and Matt's like, I didn't notice. Then he just thinks, they think it's just a cloth. I feel so weak. This to me is a little side note. I think it's one of the greatest interpretations of Captain America in any comic ever. I think it goes right to the essence of what the character really is when he tells the general, I'm loyal to nothing except the dream. And they dedicated that issue to Jack Kirby, and I'm glad they did, because I think they really went for it with the character there.
I'm going to back us up for a moment, because I just wanted to get your thoughts. I mentioned when I gave my introduction to the Miller run, I mentioned that issue 219 had the story where Miller came back in for one issue there, and John Buscema did the artwork. And it's an interesting story because Daredevil actually never appears in it. It's only Matt, and Matt never says a word in the story. So it was definitely an interesting experiment with how they handled things. To me, it didn't have me on the edge of my seat. It didn't really engage me as much as I would have hoped, but I thought it was a very interesting attempt or very interesting concept. And I'm curious if you guys had any thoughts on that one.
That issue, Paul, I have to admit, has always had very little impression on me. Maybe it, I mean, I'm a huge Buscema fan, but maybe, like you said, it just didn't feel right with Daredevil to the same degree as with some of the other characters he's rendered. That's almost like a, to me, it's almost like a forgotten bridge issue. I often forget that he actually did that issue, because it doesn't feel like it's a piece with, well, everything that's going to be happening both before and after that, especially after that. I mean, I forgive me. I could talk about Born Again. I could talk about Born Again for, let's say, 6 hours, so I'm not going to. But
what I think is interesting about that, it's in comics, we have what we have sometimes in those 22 episode television shows. Mm-hmm. I listen to the Talkville podcast where they're kind of doing a walkthrough of all the Smallville episodes, and they talk about some of the filler episodes, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
And some of them are successful. Other ones, they were experiments, not so much so.
Yep.
These are two creators who I adore, who I think gave us a good issue.
Yeah.
And
sometimes that's enough.
Yes. It is. So, I mean, and that's what that is. It's not one of those that like is on my bucket list, which is so funny because Buscema as a kid was one of those, you know, with the Marvel How to Draw Comics.
Oh, How to Draw Comics the Marvel way. Always in print by some publisher.
Right. Yep. I love the artwork. Absolutely. Oh, yeah, love his artwork and followed him because of that, because at some point when I was younger, I thought, maybe I'll be an artist or something like that from it. And I love that book just kind of opens that doorway to that thinking. But this was a good issue. But that's a lot of times the problem with good issues. It did not leave for me a lasting impression. And I think that's an interesting thing with two creators who I think are giants.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting to me in that it had been, I guess, about 3 years since Miller had written any Daredevil stories. Mm-hmm. And you would think, knowing in hindsight that Born Again was coming,
yeah,
I kind of expected something a little bit more spectacle from that issue. I expected something that was maybe going to lay some groundwork for what we were going to get in Born Again. And we got none of that, actually. We got kind of the Stranger in a Strange Land, you know, the man with no name who enters the town and changes the way things are done kind of storyline. And it was interesting for what it was, but it didn't stand out. And I, that's why I was curious to see if you guys had any thoughts on that. We go from that to Born Again, which again is just, I'm torn. And I think, Chris, this is where you and I might diverge slightly, because as much as I love Born Again, the storyline from the introduction of Elektra until her death, I think is just as good. I don't know that I could pick which one I prefer. Whereas I think you're clearly a Born Again guy.
I'm born again, but yeah, but no, you're right. But there's other storylines I cherish just as much. It's just Born Again, I think, both then and today, because I just reread it last night, actually. I got a gallery edition of it, which is gorgeous. It still affects me at such a emotional level, and that there's certain scenes where I get that chill you get as a reader when, or like you're watching a film or whatever, where you just get this feeling that your emotions are so taken in by what's happening. You know, when he has to destroy the helicopter because it's machine gunning people in the streets, and he just says forgive me because he's taken a life, which I don't think Daredevil had done up to that point. I don't think. If I remember correctly, there's just an innate power to that, because again the stakes are so huge, and like using a character like Glory, the Irish woman who was one of Matt's lovers as well, like, and her as a photographer and what she's experiencing, he masterfully follows all these different characters, and they all have their arcs, but they're all those arcs in the end serve. This story, it's masterful stuff.
I think one of the things that sticks out for me for Born Again, and I, first of all, I'm going to say both stories are brilliant. So it's kind of like you're sitting there going, oh, these are great.
Exactly. That's my point.
Yeah. So I would agree with that 100%. I lean more towards Born Again, but it's personal connection. It's personal reasons. At the time of my life when I read Born Again, I wasn't real happy with myself during that era. So you're reading this character who has... really, which is very uncommon in comics when it's the hero, really did a long decline.
Yeah. Yep. And
you're dealing that over multiple issues where he's going lower than I'm like, God, thank goodness I never went that low. But you're seeing that, and you're seeing this person have a struggle to climb back up. And when you're in that place yourself where you're like, I don't know, life's not too good right now. It's kind of like, oh, it's not so bad either. I mean, and I think that's where when you can connect with those stories and they can, you know, you can relate on some small level or parallel on some small level. That stuff is great. And that's where I think it feels so real. But both story, I mean, I don't know, there's so much about this run to love. Born Again's definitely my preference over it. And when you're holding up the trade, I was in there, yep, that's it.
Well, also, Sean, I think for me also, it's the Mazzucchelli artwork.
Yes.
So I had never seen his work before when I got the issues when they were coming out monthly. I was middle school, but I'd read a good number of comics by that point. And his art, I mean, I think it's the ultimate expression of like that noir feel of the character, and just the way he uses the shadow and, you know, he incorporates the elements, the snow, you know, the like Paolo, that homicidal lunatic drug dealer, and all these characters feel like they've just come walked right off of a movie screen, but like the most seedy, you know, 1940s noir film you've ever seen. It's great stuff.
Miller and Mazzucchelli together had a chemistry.
Yeah. Well, Batman Year One is another one of my all-time favorites.
Right.
So, yeah, their synergy. And his Kingpin is utterly terrifying.
Yes.
Utterly terrifying. Just the sheer mass of the man. But not like he's some, like, you know, roly-poly. It's just, it's the power. And when Matt goes to challenge him when he's totally out of his mind, he has the Billy Club. And the battle they fight. And Matt, like, trying to stand on his tippy toes to basically hit him with the Billy Club, and the Kingpin just relishing, just breaking bone. It's towering. It's tremendous storytelling.
Yes.
So, I don't want
to. Got me going, Paul. You got me going.
I don't want to give short shrift to Born Again.
That's okay.
But from Born Again,
you lead, I follow, Paul. You lead, I follow.
You know, we go to 1993. When Miller came out with the Man Without Fear miniseries, a 5-issue.
Actually, basically, Paul, can I interject for just 1 minute? I just want to mention that we forgot. Miller did a Marvel graphic novel, the 80s graphic novel series, the Bill Sienkiewicz, which I couldn't find it, so I haven't read it in a long time. But basically, it's like a bridge story between the Miller Jansen run and Born Again. And it involves Vanessa being sent off to Europe for her own health and safety. Have you guys read that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't own it. I've had a chance to page through it, but yeah. I never sat down and read it and gave it the time that it deserves.
I read it so long ago that I barely remember it, but
I have to say that while I totally respect Bill Sienkiewicz and his artwork and I see the greatness that's there, it doesn't do the same thing for me with Miller's work that that Jansen and Mazzucchelli do.
Mm.
It's not the same. And I'm going to say, when we get to Man Without Fear, I'm going to say the same holds true actually for Romita Jr. It's not the same for me. And that reminded me, I wanted to make mention of, there was that one issue that ended his initial run where it was Miller's pencils with Terry Austin doing the inking. And I got to tell you, I love Terry Austin's work on the X-Men. I don't think there's much better inking work that I can point to. But I don't know that it was a matchup, Terry Austin on Daredevil. Because Austin doesn't really have the noir feeling that I want.
So it's funny you mentioned that. Because when I reread that issue, I mean, the story itself is fantastic and deeply disturbing. But reading it again as a 50-year-old man, I had the reaction of, this art's a little off. Like, it doesn't really suit completely this story that's being told. It's still perfectly pleasant to look at, but it was a little jarring.
It's above average work.
Yeah.
In my opinion, it's just not the all-time classic work that we're looking at in other cases. So what we're doing is we're setting the bar extremely high.
Yeah.
When we say that it's not quite living up to what we would hope.
Well, there's the problem is you're dealing with such special runs with artists that like are like the synergy's there. You know, the understanding of the visuals that should match these, like Frank Miller, obviously, because he's an artist, is a visual storyteller. So I think when he works with certain artists that understand his style, his visual delivery, and they're able to convey that with their own talent, we get something very, very unique and special. So now we're taking artists that really are top tier artists and we're saying, they're not quite up to snuff. Yeah. And, they are, but it's just there's the chemistry's not there between them in the same way that we got to see. So I mean, think that's there again, they start looking like really amazing fill-in-ish.
Yep. Well put. That's well put, sir. All right, Paul, Man Without Fear, let's do it.
Yes, so Man Without Fear is effectively Daredevil, you know, in putting quotations, year one. It's more than a year, but it's pretty much a five-issue retelling of his origin, but it's a retelling of his origin incorporating Stick and incorporating Elektra and actually incorporating the Kingpin into his storyline. I thought it was well done. I enjoyed reading it. And again, I think it's a victim of my setting the bar so high that it just isn't the all-time classic that the other two story arcs that we've focused on are. It's really good. But I don't know that it's great. And the other ones are great.
I found so, because I reread this for this episode as well. There are aspects of the story that I think rise to the for lack of a better term, the great level for me. Other elements do not. The Matt and Foggy stuff is gold. Every scene they're in together, like Foggy in college, is all just Miller just has that character down in such a delightful way. The Elektra stuff, it's good. I think it really fleshes out nicely the origin, which we saw back in 168. I think part of it is, I always admire John Romita Jr.'s artwork, but I find he tends to draw a certain type of female character the same way over and over. And Elektra felt that way to me. Like he got, you know, her prowess as a warrior, but the way Miller and Jansen rendered her, like I said, to me, that's a real woman. This did not feel like a real woman. And so there was a bit that element of the story was a little stiff to me. But I still really enjoy, and I think it's a central book. Any dude who wants to get into Daredevil should read, without question. The stuff in the story about his father, the way he redid Slade and the Fixer and all of that, I thought was really well done. Him as a kid, Romita Jr., like his father draws great city backgrounds, like Matt as a kid on like the fire escape and all of that. And that was, you know, you got to make Hell's Kitchen part of the story if you're going to talk about Daredevil, especially Daredevil in his youth. And I think they did that really well.
It is funny reading that story in 93 as it was coming out, where it was coming out every month. If you had asked me then what I thought of it, I'm like, this is amazing. I'm loving every minute. Yeah, yeah. That was my true reaction to it then. Yeah. Now, I reread it for this. I enjoyed it. Yeah. I'm not, there's no knocks on it or anything like that. But the problem is when you compare it to what we've been reading to get to this, it's like, oh man, that's not the way to read that. I'm glad I read it for this. I really did. I mean, there's nothing I actually read for this that I was like, wow, is this a chore to get through? No, this is a joy. Like our lowest bar is really good stuff. Yes, it is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, this is a great experience because I don't know. The worst thing you're going to throw in front of me is a really good filler issue or a really good miniseries.
It just speaks to the strengths of the character as Miller. Yes. And his collaborators, how they interpreted the character and the world that they created. Like even like Turk and Grotto, which are like these throwaway, like Laurel and Hardy, you know, Abbott and Costello, take your pick, you know, Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis, whatever. That's this goofy duo. But you know, Miller uses them very effectively. I mean, or like Josie's pool hall, which is a character unto itself. And, you know, that there's like a code of conduct in the bar and, you know, don't kill anybody inside and the window always being smashed. It's such a visceral world. And again, Miller, like you guys said earlier, he clearly wanted to bring a noir sensibility. And that is for me is just baked into Daredevil now. You just associate him with that, or just think about when he and Jansen were drawing the book, and a lot of the rooms would just be like the shadows or lights coming through blinds in the windows, creating this very film noir feel, like in the Kingpin's office, the atmosphere that, I mean, if you go back to the 80s and this time period, I think Marvel was going through a wonderful creative renaissance. A lot of great stuff came out in the early to mid 1980s. But putting that aside, most comic books didn't look like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's bringing like also a Japanese aesthetic in some way to some of what he's doing, and groundbreaking stuff, really.
You can't go back and change history. But I almost think if you had somebody who came to you today and didn't know the character and said, you know, I hear good stuff about this Daredevil and the Frank Miller run. You know, what do you think? I think I might say, you know what? Read the Man Without Fear miniseries first.
And I would then say that, sure.
And then read the regular run and get to Born Again, you know, and I guess, you know, the graphic novel as well. But having not actually read that one at length, I can't say for certain.
And then,
that.
Paul, at the end, if you want to be a completist, you dig up the alternate reality Elektra Lives Again graphic novel.
Yes.
Which he did with Lynn Varley, his then wife. Have you guys read that?
Yes.
Okay. I had a copy and I lost it in the
years
flood.
And years ago.
it came out as a beautiful, like, white hardcover.
Oversized.
Oversized, yeah. And oh my God, it's graphic. Woo! Mm-hmm. And you know, it's like him. It's not considered canon, if there even is canon at this point anymore. But I think it was never considered like. Or at least Marvel didn't consider it. Maybe Miller did, but Marvel didn't, obviously. So
it had the Epic logo on it.
It did have the Epic logo. That's correct. Yep.
Which
I'm going to have to seek that out now and dig into that.
It's a fascinating visual because it's Miller. Then I think it's Lynn Varley coloring or painting. I don't remember which medium she was working in. But did you like that story, Sean?
I did.
Yeah, me too.
And I thought what really worked for it was the Epic logo. I don't throw that away lightly because you got the sense that because they were putting that in the other line, the more mature Marvel line, that the story would have been jarring otherwise.
Yeah.
Because it was so clearly, you know, meant to not be in continuity or canon, as we were talking about there. But I think because they put it in Epic, you like immediately knew as a reader that this is gonna be a little different.
Yeah, and sure was.
and I loved the oversized format. I thought it was a great way to showcase the arc in your right role boys in a violent book.
Yeah, it's woof. I think Paul's searching it out as we speak.
I'm looking for it.
One of the pieces.
But I think if anybody's listening can't tell, let me just break it down. All three of us are recommending all of the books in this
Miller
run of Daredevil.
Yes.
And I think
you know what, Paul? I have to be complete. I apologize for cutting you off, but it'll leave my head if I don't mention it. And go to when Miller first drew Daredevil in 2 issues of Spectacular Spider-Man in the Bronze Age, 27, 28, maybe something about in there. That area.
It's definitely in that range.
And Spider-Man loses his sight temporarily, and Daredevil has to help him. It's the first time Miller and apparently editorial decided to give Miller the Daredevil book because of the work he did on those 2 issues. That's what I read anyway. So if you want to be a completist.
That's a good place to start. That's, you know, in its own way, that's how John Romita Sr. drew Spider-Man.
Yeah, that's right. In a Daredevil. Yeah, that's right.
And,
well done,
and that ended up being his tryout to get the Spider-Man title.
Yep. Well
when,
done.
When Ditko left. Go ahead, Sean.
When in a conversation you stop and highlight Turk, This is a study in world building.
Yes, exactly.
Because of the fact that these are characters, there's very little in this. I think you'd be hard pressed to find something or somebody that was a bit character.
Yes.
Everybody had a story. The story was filled out. Everyone had, and that's something I think for somebody who's looking to break into comics or anything like that, as far as how do I engage an audience, you build a world like this, people are going to want to keep coming back for more. This is a true masterful study in world building.
Well done.
And then, the character of Turk is both comedic, tragic, and just interesting in its own way. And I find it fascinating the way he was presented, because at one point he gets the stilt man armor and he's still totally dismissed. Like everybody's like, oh, just get out of here, Turk.
Yeah.
And even the Kingpin is like, cause he wants to go to work for the Kingpin, and Kingpin is like, I don't care what power you have, what armor you have, what you have, you're a loser. Get out of here.
He's not even worth killing as far as the Kingpin is concerned. It just,
exactly. Yeah. So just great stuff. And I just can't tell you how much I enjoyed rereading this stuff to get ready for today.
And Paul, I want to thank you for that opportunity. It was a lot of fun.
Having already read it, I enjoyed it. So if somebody hasn't read it yet, I envy you. And I tell you, go out and seek it out, because it's all great stuff. And tune in tomorrow to Is It Yours, when the three of us and possibly anybody else who joins us will be reviewing the cinematic Daredevil. And I can tell you, while we're going to touch on the Trial of the Incredible Hulk and the Ben Affleck movie, the large majority of this is going to be the Netflix and Disney series, which are 99.9% drawn from Frank Miller's Daredevil.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
So... Yep. You can get an idea of what we might think of those just by having listened to what we said today. In the meanwhile, Chris and Sean, thank you both so much for coming on with me today.
Thank you.
Paul, it was a delight. Thanks for having me on.
It's always my pleasure. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And hopefully we'll see you tomorrow. And if we don't see you tomorrow, we'll see you next week on Back to the Bits. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.